I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio. And you're listening to The Functional Nerds. This should be episode number 237.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I am a musician and a podcaster. You can check out my website, johnanilio.com, and follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And today, we are delighted to be joined by Naomi Novik. She's the author of many books, including, how do you pronounce the series of books?
Temeraire.
I was to the Temeraire series, which she's most well known for.
I totally knew that.
I should have asked. I meant to ask before we started, but she has that whole series of books that are out, and she has her brand new one, Uprooted, which I read and loved and which you should all go and check out. And we're delighted to have her today. Naomi, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, yeah. So I know I remember before we got into all this podcasting and all this stuff online, that was a very popular, it still is a very popular series of books. What made you decide to kind of shift gears and go into writing something like Uprooted?
You know, for me, it wasn't entirely shifting gears. In fact, Uprooted actually started because I was procrastinating on the Temeraire series. I've been writing the Temeraire series for more than 10 years now, and the dragons in the Temeraire series are realist. I try to make them feel very much like real animals and try to maintain a really historically accurate universe other than that, which I think works really well with that for that story, for that set of characters. You know, I'm trying to tell basically the story of the Napoleonic Wars, and I want the reader to feel transported to that period in history. But at the same time, I love magic. I love the magic in fantasy as well. And I love just the sort of the more fantastical beasts and the use of spells and sorcery. And so I was supposed to be working on Blood of Tyrants, which was the eighth Temeraire book. And I sat down and I wrote the line, "Our dragon doesn't eat the girls he takes." And I knew almost immediately, as soon as I wrote that line, that I was writing that book. And that it was a dragon who was not actually a dragon and was actually a sorcerer, but that was going to kind of draw on a lot of the same legends and myths that I've been reading for the Temeraire universe and that I use as research for the dragons in that universe. And it's sort of, I just kind of got to play almost with the other side, even though, you know, it's not, there aren't actually physical dragons in Uprooted. A lot of that same sort of folklore and fantasy research kind of came into play.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I have lots more questions about that. But before we get into that, let's get into our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Patrick, why don't you go first then?
My pick this week is the Fate game system. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not. JT and Craig invited me to a role-playing game night and ended up introducing me to the Fate game system. And it's a core game mechanic system based on Fudge, which I'm sure, John, you're all over and you know everything about it. That used to stand for a free-form universal do-it-yourself gaming engine. Both systems are without a system. So, in other words, or a setting. So it's rules, but you can apply it to whatever game setting you're playing in. So, you know, it's not like, you know, Dungeons & Dragons, you have a D20. It's here's your game system and what do you want to do with it? And you could create a game set in Denver. You could create a game set in the time with the dragons, you know, the Napoleonic War. It's whatever you want to do with it. And I liked it because it was really adaptable. It was super simple to use. The D20 system can be a little complicated, especially when you're starting a brand new game with people and you don't know anything. And the Fate system just made it kind of simple. It's six die. You only have three things that can happen. It's either a plus, a minus, or a blank, which means you either have something enhanced, you have something not enhanced, or everything stays the same. So it was super simple. and I just enjoyed how the whole system worked. Naomi, what's your pick?
You know, I'm going to actually go with kind of a blast from the past. Mm-hmm. I've been rereading Tales from the Flat Earth by Tanith Lee.
Nice.
Who passed away just recently, of course, and it reminded me of how, you know, her work is sort of, it's one of those things that I came across for the first time when I was sort of a little too young to sort of understand everything that I was reading. And it was sort of dreamlike and just incredibly vivid. And I still remember there are moments in her books that I read, and they literally felt like sort of flashes of illumination, like you're standing in a dark room and suddenly, or actually on a dark plane, and there's a flash of lightning and you suddenly see something silhouetted that you kind of didn't perceive was there. And I don't know if that description is going to make sense to anybody else but me, because it's such a sort of idiosyncratic description. But I feel like as a writer, what I've kind of tried to take with that is that you can have sort of moments in a story, in a book, that you kind of come back to as a reader and that are incredibly powerful. And sometimes it's just, it's like a few paragraphs, a few pages that almost literally the whole rest of the book has kind of been leading up to. But when it hits, when that moment lands, it's so incredible that it just makes the whole thing.
That's awesome.
And yeah, that's something that I think is really impressive and that she does for me at least.
That is awesome.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. All right. My pick this week is The Providence of Fire. This is by Brian Staveley. This is the second book in his The Unhewn Throne Chronicles. I was a big fan of the first book, which is called The Emperor's Blades, which only came out a year ago. This may be my new favorite epic fantasy. It's a very classic kind of epic fantasy, you know, very hero's journey-ish. It's the three main character are the three children of an emperor, where the book starts off with the emperor gets killed, which is, you know, a kind of a thing that happens in a lot of epic fantasy, but it basically tells the tale of all three of them. And the first book goes into that. And then this second book is sort of the fallout of what happens in the first book. And Brian's a great writer, just, you know, a really good writer in his own right. And the story is excellent, just really well constructed. And if, you know, if what you kind of like in your epic fantasy is, you know, if you like warrior stuff, if you like monks training, if you like gods, if you like people with powers, if like all the kind of things that we like about epic fantasy, he really weaves a lot of those things into it, but in a unique way. It's not just like, oh, this is a Robert Jordan ripoff, or oh, this is a George Martin ripoff. It's really a very unique voice. And we had Brian on the show about a year ago, and I think he was, when he wrote the first book, I think he was in, I want to say he was in Nepal or something. Him and Max Gladstone both wrote their books in someplace in Asia, remote, where it was like, you know, 25 cents a day to live or something like that. But there is that sort of Asian flavor to it as well. It's great. I really love these books. So I'm sort of shouting from the rooftop about them, because I think it's, you know, it's really on the level of like a Rothfuss or a Sanderson. So that is my pick. It is The Providence of Fire. And if you haven't read the first one yet, the first one is The Emperor's Blades, and that is Brian Staveley. So very good. All right, Naomi, let's get on to it. So as I said, I read Uprooted, really loved it. One of the things that I noticed in the book, or just even noticed in sort of some of the advanced press about it, was that it has an influence of Polish fairy tales. And now I know nothing of Polish fairy tales, so I don't know how much you actually borrowed from them or if it was just inspired. So maybe you could tell us a little bit of something about the Polish fairy tales that influenced you in terms of writing this book.
Absolutely. No, my parents are both Eastern European immigrants, and we spoke Polish at home when I was growing up. So it was actually my first language. And my mother had several books of Polish fairy tales that she read to me. And also, we had several books that were not exactly fairy tales. They were about Polish history, but it was fantastical history. You know, it was the story of the Wawel Dragon the story of the king's name was Piast. No, Piast was the good king. I'm mixing people up a little bit now in my head as I am trying to remember. But basically, I had all these sorts of legends and fairy tales all kind of mixed together. And this all happened when I was still very young. So I don't, it's not that I necessarily have incredibly detailed specific memories, but I have this sort of sense of a kind of magical Poland in my mind, a Poland that is full of sort of fairies and witches and Baba Yagas in, you know, hiding in a dark corner. And the forest is incredibly important in Polish, not just in Polish fairy tales, but in Polish culture. My mother's brother, my uncle, was a forest ranger in Poland, actually. And my mother had this real sense of the forests in Poland as a place of kind of nourishment and safety and strength. And all of that influence is kind of the sort of the bedrock layer of Uprooted. It is the place, that is the setting that it takes place in. And it's not entirely a real place, and it's not drawn from a single story, but at the same time, it partakes of all of those places and all of those stories kind of brought together.
Now with some of the, you know, you mention in the book, there's many different towns that are mentioned, many different town names. Are some of those names from Poland or are those?
Yes. Just,
oh, okay.
Yes. The names are actually, I asked, you know, it helps to have a native Polish speaker in your pocket. Mm-hmm. My mother found me lots of names of small towns. Mm-hmm. In roughly in the southern part of Poland, that were relatively near Krakow,
okay.
Which, you know, that's the sort of more historical area. That's the period that very vague period that I was writing in. It wasn't the same as the Temeraire books where I have a specific ironclad date basically for every day. It's more, I had a general sense of the period that I was working in. And, you know, many of those towns, the names were taken, the people's names were largely taken from period names. Some slightly more modern names crept in because they just happened to be in my head. And so they stuck for me. And that's where a lot of those names come from. They are actual Polish names. There's real Polish food in there that I remember growing up with. And then the other interesting thing was the magic, you know, so when I had to decide on the magic language of magic, I realized that I didn't want Polish because in my head, the characters are all kind of speaking Polish, even though they're written in English. And so what I did with the language was the language is actually based on a combination of Finnish, Hungarian, and Estonian, the sort of the Finno-Ugric language group. And that's kind of my idea that the magic kind of followed that migration path.
Well, that makes sense. Cause if it was English speakers and you went to have cast a spell and you're just saying words in English, it doesn't really seem would have much of an effect if you just, right. You know, said like disappear, like that's, it's kind
yes.
of,
yeah, it feels a little flat.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you mentioned when you were talking about how your mother told you these different Polish fairy tales growing up and you didn't remember specific ones and it was sort of just more of like a feeling. What that kind of reminded me of, and I wonder if you thought about this at all, is, you know, that idea of Joseph Campbell's theory of, you know, all these different cultures from all around the world having very similar myths and creation stories and things like that. And even though they're not exact, there's a lot of, you know, similar characters and similar paths. Is that something that you thought of or were aware of at all in regards to your own sort of experience with these Polish fairy tales?
You know, I mean, there are also, I should say, there are some specific fairy tales. I have a couple of particular favorites. And in fact, my heroine is named after one of them, Agnieszka Skrawek Nieba, which means Agnieszka, piece of the sky. But, you know, I don't know if I necessarily came at it from a Campbellian perspective where it's sort of there's this lower level of collective unconsciousness almost. I think that actually stories travel. I think that stories move around the world. You know, in fact, it turned out that the book of fairy, one of the books of fairy tales that I think of as, you know, incredibly Polish, is actually based on French fairy tales that author translated. And a lot of those fairy tales have drawn elements from other parts of the world. And, you know, for myself, I mean, I actually, as the children of immigrants who didn't have their own sort of tradition of English language books and stories to tell me, I have found that just in my own head, I have like this mingling of stories coming from the Eastern European side and then from all the reading that I've done in English. And a lot of those stories kind of get mixed up and mashed together. There are lots of common threads in them. But sometimes they feel to me like common threads that are there because the stories actually moved, that, you know, a story got told in Russia and, you know, one person in one village heard it and told it to their friend in the next village, and it kind of travels along, and that there are some things around you, obviously, that things like the forests of Europe, obviously, have been incredibly formative on not just Polish fairy tales, but on German fairy tales. You know, you've got that real Schwarzwald, the Hansel and Gretel story, you know, that kind of thread where you've got points of commonality, and sometimes they might just arise spontaneously, but I think a lot of them also arise just by communication. And by those networks.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. You know, it reminds me of, I'm an elementary school music teacher, and this is something I talk about with my students sometimes with folk songs. And a lot of times we're talking about sort of American folk songs, but if you go into your different, you know, Eastern European folk songs and British folk songs and all of those, it's kind of what you're talking about with these stories being told, is that because they didn't have a way of recording them, obviously they didn't have, you can, you know, go to your computer and record yourself singing and playing a song. And really, even when you're talking about the folk music, they didn't even, in a lot of ways, they didn't have, you know, the knowledge on how to write music that kind of came later. So it sort of becomes, these folk songs are so, really stand the test of time, because they had to be either good enough in the beginning to kind of keep wanting to be resung and retold and taught to somebody else. Or I think also what happens with this stuff, and maybe it happens with some of the stories and fairy tales as well, is that it's kind of like telephone, when you play that game telephone in school.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one person teaches it to the next, and they're like, you know, I like this verse, but I'm going to change the melody here a little bit because I think it would sound better if I did this. Or I'm going to add another verse, because some of those old folk songs, you'll see, they'll have like 20, 30, 40 verses that exist because people will kind of add their verse to it. It's not like now where it's like you write a book or you write a song and you put it out there and it's copyrighted and that's the song and that's right. I think a lot of times these things just over the years just accrued lots of different, that's why they're sort of anonymous, because one person came up with it to begin with, but it's gone through so many sort of polishings over the time. Do you think that kind of happens with the fairy tales and such too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's very, very clear that's what happens with fairy tales and stories. You know, you see so many different versions of Baba Yaga, for instance. You see so many different versions of the Beauty and the Beast story. Mm-hmm. You see so many different versions of the Cinderella story. I mean, that story is something where I think there's actually a version of it that somebody knows that's from, I want to say, Tang Dynasty China. Mm. That, as far as anybody knows, is the sort of earliest version of that story. And, you know, so it's amazing how I think when you have a good story is incredibly powerful. Everybody wants to hear a good story. And, you know, and before fairly recently, it was very hard to communicate those stories. You know, I mean, forget about the internet, the invention of paper radically changed how quickly you could share a story and how easily.
Can you give us a little bit of background on the Baba Yaga? You mentioned the Baba Yaga a few times. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that story.
Well, you know, there are about as many different versions of Baba Yaga stories as I'm trying to think of who I could say. You know, it's like she's radically different than Superman. Superman's always kind of a good guy. This is like if Superman were also evil half the time, or more than half the time. My first exposure to Baba Yaga is actually from a Polish lullaby about how Baba Yaga lived in a house made out of butter. And in that house, there were many strange things. And that's my core vision of Baba Yaga, in this strange, unbelievable kind of house, sort of stirring a cauldron and sort of flashes of magic around her. There's also a very popular version of her in Russian folklore, where she lives in a house that's basically on chicken legs, and this house can actually like run through the forests, and you really don't want to meet Baba Yaga. Baba Yaga is also actually the witch from Hansel and Gretel, the one who eats the children. Mm-hmm. That is a very classic Baba Yaga story. And she's also, I mean, she can also frequently be like a trickster figure. She can sometimes be like a fairy godmother figure. And she's one of those incredibly almost generic characters on which you can use in any story almost in any way you want, as long as she is sort of elemental and powerful and kind of terrifying.
Mm. You know, you mentioned, you know, you can use that character any way you want. And that kind of brings me to something else that you're involved in. And so you're talking about using this sort of pre-established character. You also, you're the co-founder of the Organization for Transformative Works, which is a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the fair use rights of fan creators. So do you think, you know, in terms of your using, you know, different sort of characters from Polish fairy tales, you know, maybe you could tell us a little something about that.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I actually started writing fanfic. That's how I got to be a writer. I spent about 10 years writing fanfic with no actual intention of being a professional fiction writer. I wasn't going to do that. I was going to work in programming, actually. I'm a software engineer by training. And I really wanted to, and I just loved doing it for fun. And the thing is, you know, we all do it. It's not that I, you know, I think it's Picasso who says good artists borrow, great artists steal. And I think that's actually capturing something, which is when you are making what we think of as original art is basically when someone has successfully created a new piece of art that stands alone. But those are not the only valuable pieces of art. A lot of art is only appreciable. You can only appreciate lots of kinds of art if you have the context for it. It's very hard if you have literally never listened to a piece of classical music in your life and you've never heard it, and then somebody plays, you know, the Mozart's symphonies for you, or Beethoven's Fifth. I think it's really kind of hard to understand, and not necessarily something that you're going to love or think is a great work of art if you just literally have never experienced anything, any part of that. And I think that's really true, especially, you know, all of fantasy, really, when you think about it, is modern fantasy is so built on Tolkien. Mm-hmm. And on what Tolkien did. And what Tolkien did is incredibly built on like the Eddas and the sagas and Old English literature. And, you know, we are all standing on the shoulders of the people before us. And the idea that we're not, the idea of sort of the lone solitary creator, you know, burning the firmament and coming up with something completely new out of their skull, like Athena smashing through Zeus's skull. it's a lie. And it actually, you know, I actually feel quite strongly about this. Obviously I founded a nonprofit organization about this. But I really feel that it's actually a very harmful lie that encourages people not to tell stories, that encourages people not to tell their own stories and not to think, oh, I can do that too. You know, that's one of the amazing things about fairy tales and folklore that kind of gets lost, that has kind of gotten lost in the sort of more authoritative version of publishing, which I think is now kind of getting reclaimed in the digital age, where the idea that we are all storytellers, we are storytelling creatures. That's kind of how we organize our days. We tell ourselves stories about what happened today. You know, you come home, like, what did you do today? You tell a story. You don't actually sit there and narrate, well, first I got up and I walked across the room and I took 10 steps across. You know, you don't, you're telling a story, you're telling a condensed narrative. And all of us do that. And all of us, I think, have interesting elements to add to stories. And I really value that kind of shared creativity that happens in fan fiction and also in original fiction, where you have people kind of playing off each other. And I think that it's really, and I think that the sort of division between sort of original in one box and fan fiction in another box is a false division and a damaging one.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the classical music as an example. I studied music history in college, and one of the things that you come across is when you get beyond Beethoven, like I think sort of the pinnacle of musical, or we'll call Western musical development. What happens after the fact is composers kept trying to push the limits of what could be done. And you sort of get to the points of composers like Schoenberg and Weber, where they were using 12-tone rows, where there was no sort of discernible melody to it. It was just all, it was basically almost like math as music. And it was very groundbreaking, but almost unlistenable. And so you could say like, oh, they had a totally original take on music, and they were like, you know, really breaking ground, but it didn't really resonate with people. And you would be really hard pressed to find those pieces really played too often, even in this day and age, because it was almost kind of too out there. And it's sort of like the tradition of classical music is, you know, if you go to see an orchestra play, they're still going to play a lot of Mozart and Beethoven, yeah, because that's sort of our base. That's what, you know, our sort of shared thing.
Well,
is.
And frankly, everybody's heard it in Looney Tunes cartoons.
Right. Yeah.
Right? You know, and we know, right? We all know that exposure to things makes us like them more. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't really like, you don't like a song the first time you hear it. You like it the like 10th time you hear it. Mm-hmm. Or that's when it starts to sort of become meaningful to you. And I think that's true of sort of elements of fiction as well. And I don't know, I feel like it's sort of a little silly to me, when people kind of try to ignore that and try to act like the thing that is to be valued is originality as opposed to a really great execution of something that you haven't seen done exactly that way before.
Yeah, you'll hear a lot of times an editor or a publisher going, "Well, it's a good story, but it's just not different enough." And
right.
A lot of times, what they want,
yeah,
what they want is they still want the hero's journey; they just want a unique take on it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think of it like food. Actually, I think it is interesting in this way, where you still, no matter what you're eating, you don't want to eat like something inedible. If you go to a restaurant and somebody hands you a plate full of like rocks and twigs, you'll be like, well, this is a really original cuisine, but I can't actually eat this. And I think, you know, there we're actually sort of physically constrained. You know, you can't actually feed somebody a rock and a piece of paper or and a piece of plastic or something, because otherwise somebody would probably try. But at the same time, you don't, and you are also entirely happy to have, you know, if you go to a nice restaurant and somebody gives you just like a steak, not groundbreaking, but you're still, if it's a really fantastic steak, perfectly cooked, really great ingredients, you're totally happy to eat it, even if you've eaten like 500 steaks before.
Yeah.
Or you're also happy to go to a restaurant and get like an incredibly elaborate dish that's not, like, that's very unusual, but still has flavors in it that your brain can kind of understand and that you have some context for. I think that's kind of similar, that's what we want from most experience. You know, that's what we want from a new piece of media. We want something that we haven't seen exactly before, because if we want something that we've seen exactly before, we'll just pick up the book that we loved the first time and reread it.
Well, but I liken it to, if you bring it forward a couple hundred years and you're looking at music again, you had essentially these blues players who did not have success in America, but they went overseas and they influenced all of these young British teenage boys who, like John, Paul, George, and Ringo, they became classically trained musicians, but then they took this influence of blues and they put it into their music and they brought it back to America and blew everybody away.
Yeah.
And people are going, wow, this is so different. This is so cool. And meanwhile, you know, you've got these blues players who are suing them for stealing their songs and their music. You know, suing the Rolling Stones because you stole our music. Suing Led Zeppelin because you stole our music. But it's essentially, you know, it's what you're talking about. It's they had this great song. They had this great sound. They had this great music, but it just wasn't really appreciated here. They took it somewhere else, and it completely influenced the whole genre of music and came back as the British Invasion.
Yeah,
you know, you were mentioning food, and I have to mention this because I had a few students a few years ago. They were brothers, and they were Eastern European. I think they were Polish. There was Marek and Stanley were their names, and one played violin and one played cello. And we had end of the year concert, and they were great. They were two of my best students, and their mother, who wasn't a strong English speaker, at the end, sometimes I'll get gifts, and it's always nice, something like a Starbucks gift card or something, but she handed me a bottle. And it was brown inside, and it had, now in Polish, is it a different alphabet that's used for Polish?
No, Polish has several letters that aren't in the standard Latin alphabet.
Okay.
But it's, the trick, actually, it's interesting because what makes Polish very hard to read is actually that there are many sounds that are actually represented by letters in the Cyrillic alphabet,
okay,
which in Polish end up represented by combinations of letters. So you get like DZ and SZ, and it makes it very, very hard. It looks like it's impenetrable.
Yeah, this looks like it might have been Cyrillic because I feel like I couldn't even recognize a letter on this bottle. And I brought it home to my wife, and I looked at this and I'm like, what do you think this is? She's like, I don't know, but that'll get you drunk. that's what that looks like. And I'm like, probably. But yeah, so, you know, Naomi, I feel like we could talk about
this. Hold on, John. You mentioned food, so therefore I have to mention, when we lived in Chicago, one of our favorite things, and actually when we moved to California, we used to have people ship these to us, were these Polish bread dumplings.
Mm.
And they were these huge, thick dumplings, right? And you would steam them, and they had this kind of brown gravy that would go with them, and different kind of bits of meat, and it was just, they were the best dumplings. I loved them. And like I said, for years when we were living in California, we would have my aunts and uncles in Chicago still ship them to us, like freeze them and ship them overnight to us in California. And then my grandmother would make them, and we'd just have, and we're not Polish, we're Irish. But, you know, we would just have, like, it would be like a huge Sunday dinner or something. It's like, oh, you know, we've got bread dumplings. And we would tell all the other family in Fresno, you know, like, oh, we have bread dumplings. And we would make these bread dumpling dinners. It was wonderful. I loved them.
Yep. We used to, we live in New York, so we're fairly near Greenpoint, where there's still a very thriving Polish community and lots of Polish stores. So every Christmas, my mom would go out there and bring back like bags of pierniczki, which are these gingerbread cookies that were always my favorite. I would literally go through these were sort of like little packages, little cellophane wrapped packages of cookies. And I, which had like, I think 8 cookies in them, and I could go through like 4 of those. And I was like 10 years old. I could do a number on them.
Oh, I used to be the one who wanted to eat all of the bread dumplings, and I would try to eat all of the bread dumplings, and my brother, my mom, and my grandma were there like, no, you have to leave some for us. Yeah. Anyway, John, go for it.
Anyway, Naomi, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we go, I do want to plug the book one more time. It's called Uprooted. It's out now. I loved it. You know, within the science fiction and fantasy reading community, so many people that I know that have read this have equal, if not more, praise for it than I do. So go and check it out. I think you will be very pleased. It has a lot of what we talked about, but lots of other stuff. This book starts off one way and ends up another way. It really surprised me as I got into it, and I loved all of it. So
Thank you. Check
it out. No, you're very welcome. Uprooted, go and check that out. Naomi, is there anything you want to let people know about in terms of website, Twitter, any cons that you may be going to?
Yes, I am at Naomi Novik on Twitter, and that's the easiest way to sort of get in touch with me directly. Like, if you have a question for me, that are Goodreads, actually. I like the Goodreads questions a lot because they're sort of, you can actually go back and refer to them. I also have a website at naominovik.com that is maintained for me by the wonderful Sean Speakman.
That's convenient that you got your name. That's.
Yes. Well, it helps that I think that if you search for my name, you know, on that site that tells you how many other people have your name, very few do, because my family preserved the spelling, Novik. But they changed the W to a V, but they didn't add the CK. They didn't make it CK, which most Polish people in this country, most Polish immigrants in this country use that spelling. So my name frequently gets misspelled by other people, but my website is available. So yes, and I'm on Tumblr as well, and Instagram. But Twitter's sort of, you know, Twitter's sustainable for an author who's also trying to get books written. Yeah, I think
cons.
That's,
any cons?
Oh, cons, yes. I'm going to be at San Diego Comic-Con this very shortly. And after that, I'm going to Space City Comic-Con in Houston. So I'm very excited for that. And after that, I'm going to be at Dragon Con. And I don't know how many Polish listeners you have, but I will be at Copernicon in Poland in September.
Awesome.
That's the end of my schedule for this year. No more travel for me after that.
Well, that seems like a good one. All right. Awesome. For me this week, just you can go check out some of my music over at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Patrick, how about you?
Usual stuff. Check out my posts at Kirkus. Check out the SF Signal podcast. I continue to do stuff over there. Approaching 300 episodes, John.
I know. It's a lot. Two a week will really rack them up after a while.
Crazy.
All right, Naomi, thank you so much for joining us today. All right, everybody, we will see you next time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?